This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin, with me Tan Chung Han and Joyce Goh. Good morning, both of you. It's almost midweek.
Good morning.
Almost midweek. Okay. Now, quite a bit of news flow around prizes for media, prizes for work done in the media, and some ways that has had significant effects in society. And what's fascinating is the Reuters win for award. They got a Pulitzer for their reporting on the Philippines, the link between President Duterte and the death squads, as well as the ethnic cleansing issue in Myanmar-Bangladesh border.
Yeah, so the Pulitzer is right. This is the most prestigious award in journalism in America. So it honors one U.S. media, right? So Reuters, they're begging two, one for photography and one for their journalistic work.
Is it just American media or is it global media? Because I think of Reuters as a global organization.
I think they're American media, but they have a lot of bureaus and offices around the world. So yeah, but we tend to think of them as global,
right?
But they are American, if I'm not mistaken.
I mean, how much are we affected by images? It seems that we often talk about the story that is rendered in text form, right, rather than the images. But the images are essential to conveying the story, especially that it's there in the newspapers, it's there in our websites or portals and such.
Yes, they say a photo or a picture paints 1,000 words, and you can see, especially for our news articles, sometimes we're reading the papers, you see the headline, but sometimes the photo is the one that attracts you to the story, and it can tell so much. You know, like photojournalism is definitely something that is eclipsed by normal writing journalism, but I think that's equally as important to recognize.
I mean, and for us to try and describe those pictures, right? Some really iconic pictures that came out, say, for example, in Syria, the little boy in the back of the ambulance, you know, or when it comes to the refugee crisis, the picture of the child lying face down in the sand. Like, so many of these iconic pictures, and these are just recent ones, right? So it's one thing to try and describe them on radio, but to see it, it just evokes a whole different set of emotions.
Exactly. You know, you try to capture the moment when you see the photo. It's very different than reading it on print or online. It's so different.
Right. In fact, if you think of some of the classic images that have come out of Southeast Asia, if you think of the child who was, you know, who had napalm, she was burning from napalm, she's running down the street naked.
Napalm girl,
And then, of course, you know, the monk in South Korea, sorry, South Vietnam, who immolated himself. And I mean, it goes on and on. The helicopter lifting the American star from the embassy as, you know, America departs.
Iran embassy?
No.
Or which embassy?
This would be even Vietnam. In Vietnam as well, okay. Right? I mean, there are these iconic moments. Also, the EDSA revolution in the Philippines, providing some of the, I think, the most compelling images that stay with you beyond the words that were written around them. But in fact, we have a little tweet. We're going to put out a story of a Singaporean photographer, and this is on the BBC World Service website, talking about the Singapore he's lost. And I think some of that dynamic of nostalgia is there in that story.
Also, you've got the New York Times and the New Yorker winning a joint Pulitzer for the expose on Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah. That's a big story. I mean, definitely a lot of investigative journalism went into that. And yeah, great for them. I mean, the report sparked the whole Me Too, hashtag Me Too movement, as well as a broad pushback against sexual harassment in many industries. And it's gone global. You know, it's not just in the US, but it's a movement that has gone global. A lot of awareness has come out from that. So yeah, that's
great. Quite significant. I think it makes you feel good about being part of the industry, part of the in attempt to kind of create not just awareness, but also to dig deep and to find those stories that really matter.
Make a difference,
absolutely. In fact, the Malaysian investigative journalism outfit that's associated with the Star, it's under the Star, the Rage Team, which is kind of a youth media kind of initiative. It's been nominated for an American award called the Peabody, which is also one of the most prestigious awards coming out of the American media scene. So we have the Pulitzer, but you also have the Peabody.
This is for their story, Predator in My Phone, undercover investigation of online child sexual crimes. That is, that's how the story was, that's how they got nominated for this. And that's great. It's great that Malaysian media has been picked for this.
Yeah, and just to, you know, kind of plug some of our episodes, then we had Ian Yee, who is the editor of Our Age, on Pressing Matters back in December of last year. You can check out the podcast. In fact, Our Age appeared on Pressing Matters. That's our show that comes on at 9:30 a.m. on Mondays, and that kind of seeks the story behind the headlines. We had them on that program twice in December, actually. So feel free to check out those podcasts.
Yeah. Okay, we'll be back with a look at Netflix. Now, if you're a Netflix subscriber, tell us how important Netflix is to your life. You can tweet us at BFM Radio, WhatsApp us 018-789-8899. We'll be back. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, the Steve Miller Band with Take the Money and Run. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Joyce Goh and Tan Chung Han. Time to talk about Netflix. It's a platform that's come to dominate many of our lives. It's added some 7.4 million subscribers in the first 3 months of this year, up 50% from the same quarter earlier last year. And it now has some 125 million subscribers. That's huge. Do you count yourselves as part of that? Tell us. You can tweet us at BFM or radio or WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Han, are you a Netflix subscriber?
No.
Oh, that's
well, you know, okay, well, let me quantify this.
You're going to nuance that answer?
Yeah, look, because I was an early adopter of Netflix while they were still handing out those DVDs, okay? Those were the days. Now, not so much.
What do you mean DVDs?
Oh, you guys didn't know? Ah, I see, you didn't know. Let me school you a little
this
bit.
This is right. Like, this is Netflix in the 80s, is it?
the noughties.
1980s.
Here's how Netflix worked, started off. So initially, there were all these blockbuster, you know, videos like your neighborhood stores with all those VHS tapes and whatnot and DVDs stacked up. Uh-huh. So these guys came in and disrupted that service model. So what they said was, you just pay a flat fee of, say, you know, $10 a month or whatever, and you can have up to 3 or more DVDs at any given time, and you don't have to return them. You can just hold on to them as much as you want, right? And then when you're done with it, you can exchange it, you know, so there's no such thing as late fees and all that kind of stuff which your neighborhood VH store or DVD store would charge.
Right, so the current Netflix now is you just have access to it from your home,
yeah,
and you can watch a lot of movies or series.
Oh, is that what happened? I haven't.
Yeah,
you haven't been keeping up with the platform. No, because, you know, for some of us who are on Netflix, there are things about it. This is what's scary about big business today, is that they understand the human psyche. Because I think business has always been trying to understand it. And consumer behavior is very much part of that. So they push those buttons, right? One of the buttons they push is binge watching. So basically, you can watch a whole season back to back. I mean, you can watch every episode in that season back to back. And you don't have to defer gratification. One of the most difficult lessons for any individual to learn, deferring gratification.
Yeah, and Shra, the scary thing is that once they know what you like, they keep pushing you the same kind of content. It's data analytics, right? Like currently, that's the whole tech industry, what the current new industry is about. And as you binge watch, you lose out on what sleep, and, you know, there's this whole, I don't know, fear of missing out thing that comes into your lives, and, you know, it just changes the whole psychology of people.
Oh, you weak-minded people.
Okay, but it's true, hon. You know, I think the issue is not so much because it's not self-generated. It's actually generated through your peers, right? And I think that's why the marketing of the new shows are so important. So if you remember, if you drove down Federal Highway, you would have seen the big billboards for Bright, you know, which starred Will Smith and somebody who looks like an orc fairy miscegenated creature. I don't know what it was. But anyway, so then everybody's talking about it, and you're kind of like anticipating that. And then once it's come on, there's so much chatter about whether you caught it, whether you liked it. Don't have the spoilers and such.
And you know, this one, Netflix launched, I think, during the first quarter this year, they've launched 18 original series and 11 new seasons for existing original series. So it's all about coming out with original content. I mean, recently Netflix just announced the results. And, you know, you can see that they are, I mean, content is so expensive. They're saying that, you know, they're going to spend as much as $8 billion on shows and movies this year, up from $6 billion US dollars in 2017.
Right.
So you can see the amount of investment they have to put into this and, you know, the content costs and, yeah.
Yeah, but I guess the big difference is that, you know, the vast majority of Netflix users are actually paying subscribers. You know, so there is money to be made here, as opposed to the Facebooks and the Googles and the Twitters and whatnot. They rely more on advertising dollars, right? So this one, you've got direct revenue being generated from these over 100 million users, right?
How did you miss out on House of Cards? I mean, you say you're no longer on... So do you never watch House of Cards?
Yeah, House of Cards, Game of Thrones,
The
I'm
Crown?
Good.
Ain't well, no Game of Thrones, I think,
is not Netflix.
I've not watched Game of Thrones as
When I decided...
Well, hold on. Neither of you have watched Game of Thrones. What planet would you like to live on?
Look, I watched one episode of Game of Thrones while on the flight from New Zealand to Australia, right? It was so uncomfortable because there's all this...
nudity.
Yeah, nudity, right?
Yes, okay. And I'm watching the word. It's okay.
Right, and I'm watching it right next to this other guy who can, you know, basically see what I'm watching. And it was really weird.
It was like sitting with your family and watching something with nudity.
Right.
No, I mean, no, the nudity is it's a very small part of the story. The story is so compelling.
That's not what I heard.
It's a metaphor for life.
But it's a lot of time invested into that, though.
It is. I mean, and you know, there is such great television. Some people are saying television now, you know, is like equivalent to the great novels of the 19th century and the 20th century. So The Wire, for instance. I mean, if you're interested in American society, you cannot not watch The Wire. It's like must. It's more than recommended. It is like essential.
Look, my TV viewing repertoire, I guess, is kind of stuck in the noughties, you know, because since I left the States, I really didn't have the time to really binge watch or just follow a series. I'm going back to, you know, The Office, US version, Survivor. And
Survivor.
24, yeah. So that's how long ago.
It's really retro, man.
Yeah, I know.
Well, coming back to Netflix, they've announced that their revenue is actually 3.7 billion US dollars. That's quite high. And looking at earnings per share is about 64 cents. So they are making money. Definitely have to, but they have a negative cash flow of 287 million US dollars. So have to watch into that cash flow. And yeah, definitely a business model to look out for.
Okay. Well, tell us how you feel about not just Netflix, but all those things that you can consume via your television or your devices and how it's changing your life. Remember, you can always tweet us at BFM Radio, WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. We'll come back and look at sleep deprivation, one of the serious consequences of binge watching and also that kiasu attitude when it comes to missing out on those big shows. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Bon Iver with For Emma. I'm Sharad Kutin with me, Joyce Goh and Tan Chung Han, and The Morning Run continues. It's just 20 minutes after 6 in the morning and it is the 17th of April. Thank you very much, Shanti. Your WhatsApp reads, just finished binge watching Money. Season 2. I think it's one of the best movies I've seen in a long time. Highly recommended, says Shanti. Now, does it make you feel that you need to rush back home and play... What is it called again?
Money.
Money. Play money. You feel... Yeah, I mean, when somebody makes a recommendation, do you feel excited by it?
I kind of put it on the list of to watch. You know, yeah, but I have kind of a long list on that to catch up on.
Right.
But yeah, but you do file it in, right? Especially if someone recommends it to you, you're like, oh yeah, you know, it's definitely something that you look out for.
Well, obviously, being the most secure person in this room right now, I don't actually. So,
oh, you see, okay, so this
I'm taking this elitist mindset right now. So, okay, yeah, you are beneath me.
No, that's because he has no access to Netflix.
Right. So you know, let's okay. Okay, folks. Now, there's a phenomenon called entertainment backlog, right? And this is precisely what you were talking about, Joyce, this idea of a list of things you want to get to. Not a bucket list, because that's something you do before your life ends.
It's like a to-watch list,
yeah,
right?
But a to-watch list, right? Okay, so we spoke to Dr. Anasuya Jagadevi Jagadasan, who's the academic head of the master's program as well as the counseling program at Help University, to help us understand what this entertainment backlog is and the consequences thereof.
Everybody has 24 hours. No matter whether you're the president of the United States, no matter whether you're a street cleaner, no matter whether you're a five-year-old, if at the end of a day you sit down and you go, you know, I'm grateful for the time I had because I achieved all this stuff. Then the next day becomes something else to achieve. If you are the kind of person who at the end of the day sits down and goes, oh my God, I didn't do this. I am not doing well in my life. I have so many things to do and I'm not doing it. Do you really think tomorrow you're going to be doing anything? You're going to be doing the same thing at the end of tomorrow night. This is not about the entertainment. This is not about the knowledge. This is not about how much you watched and which one you watched or you feel left out. This is about your attitude towards life. If you're going to let the idea of I missed out be those last thoughts before you go to sleep at night, it doesn't matter what new stuff you see tomorrow. My prediction would be for the preponderance of nights, you would be focusing on what you missed out on rather than what you actually achieved.
That was Dr. Anasuya Jagadasan. Speaking, she's of course from Help University, and speaking about the notion of an entertainment backlog that is in fact changing the way people make choices in their lives.
Actually, guys, I think this is more FOMO, you know, fear of missing out, you know, as a case of that, where you fear of what I'm missing out on and you think about that. But it's very difficult, I think, to be in bed at night and not figure out, you know, have your mind thinking before you go to bed. I don't know about you guys, but I'm one of them that, you know, you kind of think back about the day and what's lying ahead of you. It's something that it's like a, I'm not sure, is it a habit or I don't know. It's something that definitely should kick
off. Well, isn't that necessarily a bad thing to do a review of the day and maybe even anticipate what you want to do the next day? But if it's dominated by the question of entertainment, especially the chatter around entertainment, is that good for you?
Right. Well, I guess, you know, because with entertainment being a want and not necessarily is not a need, right? So I guess those concerns or that mind space is somewhat misplaced, right? Now, if we broaden this conversation and perhaps, you know, just talk about this concept about whether or not you should go to bed at night being content with what you've achieved, you know, versus this, you know, being driven by this fear of missing out, then there are risks on either side, right? So, for example, if let's say you go to bed content, you know, and you just ponder upon what you have achieved, you know, the risk is that there might be some complacency that creeps in, right? As opposed to on the other side, and this just my two cents. I suppose on the other side, if you have this fear of missing out, then the risk is that there could be this bigger desire to go out there and achieve more the next day, hopefully. I mean, obviously within a healthy framework, lah.
Yeah, and if you're a parent, there's like all this to-do list for your kids as well and the household and everything else. So it's not just for yourself, right?
Yeah, I think for me, one of the things that Netflix has done is it's gotten me off binge-watching art house movies. And that used to be my thing. And there's a platform called Mubi.com that you can go to, which provides, and this is very interesting, the model is this. It gives you 20 shows that you could watch. And as, you know, but there's a time limit on each of the shows that you can watch. And so it just sort of, it rotates. And you can see, well, you only have 2 days left to watch this, catch the show before it ends. And there's this feeling that you might be missing out. Because the great thing about films is that it's always going to be there somewhere, right? And you can always watch it at any time. But art house movies, I'm missing out on because of Netflix.
Well, you know, a new survey shows that Malaysians generally have a hard time getting good quality sleep, with 9 out of 10 suffering from one or more sleep problems. That's a lot. And yesterday was World Sleep Day 2018.
Well, we'll come back to talk about sleep later on. We're coming up to the first bulletin of the morning with and taking us there is Natalie Imbruglia with a Wrong Impression, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, charted at the top by the 80s English band, The Style Council. I'm Sharad Kutta, with me, Joyce Goh and Tan Chung Han. We were talking about Netflix as well as sleep. So Netflix flicks might lead you to lose sleep. And we actually have a tweet out asking you, if you're the 1 in 10 Malaysian who gets good sleep, tell us what your secret is, because 9 out of 10 Malaysians apparently are sleep deprived. Now, that's a shocking stat if there ever was one.
Yeah, so this is according to the First National Sleep Survey conducted by Nielsen Malaysia and also M Life. So, and also keeping in mind, yesterday was World Sleep Day 2018. Maybe that explains why I had a relatively good night's sleep yesterday.
Yeah, I did a long nap as well. Well, thank you very much, Suresh Raj, for your WhatsApp message. You're saying that Netflix has an unsustainable business model because of weak piracy laws outside developed countries or in developing countries and such. There is a problem with a lot of, well, piracy is one thing, but, you know, you talked about DVDs earlier, but also maybe a lot of peer-to-peer sharing sites that people avail themselves
of.
Yeah,
it's a good point. I mean, piracy is definitely something that a lot of media people stay up at night for, because it's something that is very real right now and it's very hard to control. And at the end of the day, that is a definite threat to them. So they're not competing with each other sometimes. They're competing with the piracy. That is an issue, a real issue for them.
Right.
Today.
What about the media that has to deal with the fact that the Googles and the Facebooks of the world just, you know, provide links to their stories? So they're not getting the income and the eyeballs for the work that they do, right?
Well, I mean, they can measure that kind of traffic via clicks and all that kind of stuff, right? But going back to Netflix, Netflix's business model, it's not just piracy that they have to contend with, but it's also the tremendously competitive space when it comes to online streaming, right? Here in Malaysia, you have not just Netflix, you've got iFlix, you've got Timsam, you've got Tonton, Astronego, right? So many, right? And
they're providing very different types of fare,
right? Yeah, it
boils
down to content.
Right, yeah, so it boils down to content, right? But still, you know, you've got these same set of eyeballs that are split across multiple platforms, right?
Okay, so we're all losing sleep over all kinds of different issues. Some of us are losing sleep over the upcoming general elections. And part of the issue will be, you know, who you vote for. And into the mix come all kinds of interesting faces, including the possibility of Raja Bomo. He, of course, was the man famous for his attempts to conjure up the missing MH370 during the debacle all those years ago. And also Beauty Queen. Beauty Queen has entered into a contest in Sabah. And she's very interesting because she's not just a beauty queen.
Right, well, and her name is also...
Rampas. Rampas is her surname.
Yeah, so, you know, the headline in the Star actually reads, Beauty Queen Rampas out to steal hearts of voters in Kulu, Sabah.
Okay, very clever pun there by the Star. But she won what was called the Sabah Harvest Festival or the Unduk Ngadu Festival. Apparently, it's a high-profile event in Sabah. She's just 29. She's a law graduate. And she has been on the stump, you know, and sort of working the ground for the last year. So she's not just a pretty parachute kind of politician.
Right. So, you know, I guess whether or not this will actually translate into votes, you know, because there's certainly plenty of hype. The name certainly adds to the color for that seat being contested there. But, you know, whether or not voters on the ground will actually vote for her despite the perceived lack of experience, right? Although, like you pointed out, she has been campaigning on the ground for the last year.
She has been going from kampong to kampong since April last year. So she's been going on to the ground. I mean, it's not just... And it's great to have a new young talent coming on board. And I think she is, if you read the story, she does go down to the ground and, you know, she's talking to people. It's not just from a high ivory tower kind of
So interesting about her is that her family is actually quite political. Both her mother and father were involved in politics. So she's not unfamiliar with that landscape. The question really is, for voters, would you trust somebody so young and apparently, inexperienced, whereas as opposed to somebody who is experienced? I mean, does that really count? Or would you go for the anti-establishment candidate or the non-establishment candidate, as it were?
Age aside, at the end of the day, it should be about sincerity and the talent, you know, whether or not you find them sincere. You know, like right now, they can come and talk to you and promise you so many things. Whether or not they can walk the talk and take it through if they win, or it's just empty promises. Age has nothing to do with that. Experience may, but then again, who knows, right? At the end of the day, it's the person, I find.
Well, I think, look, age and experience has, I think, plenty to do with that, right? Because, you know, when it comes to, say, the execution risk of the policies, whether or not you can deliver on the ground, it's one thing to go from door to door, knock, knock, say hi, hand out a few pamphlets. It's another thing to fight with the state government or the federal government for scarce resources, right? If you look at, say, the Teluk Intan by-election, they went for Ma versus Diana, right? Even though Diana was very attractive, right? Because I guess that attractive, community was relatively risk averse.
Mm-hmm. But age, you're saying that young. But I feel that if you don't give the young people.
There was also a question of ethnicity in that case too, wasn't there?
Yeah, but if you don't give the young people a chance to prove themselves, and if the old guards can never let go, then you'll never get new blood. You'll never get new experiences, new talent into the system.
Right. So it's something that voters will have to decide, right? You know, the cost of switching over, right? Are you willing to take that risk moving to the younger and, I guess, perhaps untested candidate?
You know, one thing that Joyce, you bring up, which I think is quite interesting, is the question of sincerity. How exactly do you measure sincerity? Mm. Because people can be, I mean, you know, used car salesmen could be sound very sincere and convincing, right? And it's an act. Sincerity is also a projection of a particular kind of persona, right? So some people do sincerity much better than others.
And that is true. Projector sincerity. Sincerity means they will follow true. After they're voted, they follow true. They'll do
that's expectation,
that
right? That they are true to their word. They mm-hmm. actually mean what they say. Mm-hmm. But if you're a new candidate, how do you know that the person will? In fact, in some ways, you have to kind of take a risk, right? You say, well, let's try this person out. But then you're saddled with that person for 5 years because, you know, as some Malaysian voters have found, they voted for somebody who then jumped party. And, you know, that's happened in the past. I mean, remember mm-hmm. the debacle in Perak? It was caused by two, state assembly people jumping ship. And, you know, and so can you imagine the voters who put their trust in those individuals who then betrayed them?
Right. And look, when it comes to aspirations, right, very often, if I may use the same word that you use, Joyce, there, right, you project your aspirations on these candidates, right? You know, whether or not that actually translates into some real results, that's a question mark, you know, be it with the status quo, the incumbents, or even with the new guys, right? So I guess every individual will have to draw their line in the sand.
The incumbent party can still also introduce fresh faces. I'm talking about the person, not the party.
Okay, we'll be back with a look at moral leadership. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, The Doors with Light My Fire. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Joyce Goh and Tan Chung Han. It's just 51 minutes past 6 in the morning. It's the 17th of April. And thank you very much to Anonymous for sending us a WhatsApp. It says, the question is a rhetorical question, I believe. Didn't Hannah Yeo contest as a novice 2 elections ago and win by the second highest majority in Selangor? So that is, to the discussion we were having earlier about whether you go for experience or somebody new with fresh new ideas.
Yeah, age shouldn't be a factor.
Right, look, but there are obviously many factors that go into these, into voters' decisions, right? So it's one thing for Hannah Yeo, I mean, and full credit to her, okay? I'm not trying to take credit away from her, you know? It's one thing for Hannah Yeo to be competing in a place like Subang Jaya versus, say, another seat which has a very different racial demographic, right? You know, because you've got, I mean, just because you have these success stories doesn't mean that you've got these stories like Diana Sofia, right? Now, she didn't fare well in the Teluk Intan by-election as well. So there are many other factors.
She was not given a chance to prove.
What, because she didn't win?
Yeah, but if she had won, if she was given a chance to prove herself,
okay,
who knows?
First things first, obviously they have to win, lah.
Yeah, okay, let's move on to this, what has been a long-standing war of words, I mean, that demonstrated by the two of you, it's a short-lived one though, between the US President Donald Trump and the former FBI Director James Comey. Because Comey has just come out with a book, A Higher Loyalty, Truth, Lies, and Leadership. And he's now on a kind of media tour to promote the book, in which he accuses Donald Trump of being morally unfit. Mm. Donald Trump has come back with the most elegant expression. He says James Comey's a slime ball, and as a consequence, the longstanding feud continues. But the question of unfit for leadership, morally unfit for leadership, that's the accusation that Comey makes against Trump. How do we understand that in the kind of a Malaysian context? What would be for you somebody who's morally unfit?
Well, okay, look, the traditional, I guess, aspiration is that you would have these leaders who are morally fit, who can set the moral tone and the cultural tone, etc., right? You know, I get it. At least, you know, in terms of, say, not attracting those controversies, being able to hold that office without risking any kind of fallout, you know, that's always the ideal scenario, right? But I'm trying to toy with this idea here about whether or not these so-called leaders or politicians really set the tone for our you know, a moral and cultural compass? Because I'm thinking, like, as an individual, regardless of whether or not you see that leader, and I'm using air quotes there, as morally fit or not, can't you set your own moral or cultural tone? I'm just trying to explore this idea here.
Well, you know, I think one of the issues, of course, is how you understand the word moral. You're talking about private morality, meaning the kinds of bad things one might do, your relationship, you know, your relationship to, in the case of Donald Trump, to women and such. But or is it about his respect or lack of respect for institutional arrangements, right?
Okay.
So this, I think, is where the morality is. So you're not in tune with the political culture of your country and your society, and you just in case, you know, have desires for to kind of push your own personal agenda regardless of those larger ideals.
Well, sure, when you talk about morally fit, I feel like when it comes to a corporate leader, to me, I mean, if the person commits fraud or is taking money from the company or is cheating the company, in that perspective, I think, yeah, that's morally unfit. But the personal life, perhaps there's a line there. But for politicians, I think there's this argument as well on when you're a politician, your personal life is also kind of like part of the whole compass of things, right? So yeah, it depends.
Yeah, I think we want to distinguish between things that are criminal in nature, right? So somebody is criminal, done something criminal, that's one thing.
Or fraud,
but,
yeah.
Yeah, but then there's the question of morality is not about crime as such, right? I mean, of course, that's it's implied, but you can be,
it could be,
you can fail morally without having done anything criminal.
Right. So, okay, going back to the example that you used, right? I guess with corporate leaders, it's one thing if they cheat, then it comes at a cost to the company, right? There is a tangible cost to employees, etc. As opposed to if he does something in his personal life, it doesn't directly affect you. Mm. And that's the line of reasoning I'm trying to employ here. So, for example, if let's say your MP, this is purely fictional here, right? But if let's say your MP or your adun has an affair, what do you do then?
Well, you know, I'm not particularly, I must say personally, I don't mind somebody's personal issues of private morality I put aside. Actually, I'm not, for me, I don't expect saints, I don't expect to elect saints, right? What I want them to do is, as long as those choices do not affect their ability to do their job. And so for me, competence is much more important in a politician than
private morality.
Those issues of private morality, because those things can be debated endlessly, right? The competence in terms of delivering on policy and actually managing a government, I think that's much more important.
I agree, Shira. I mean, if the person, let's say in your example, Han, does not have an affair and it's, or his or her private life, but the person is taking money or cheating people, that are affecting the lives of people, then is that okay? I don't know.
I'm with Shira there. You know, I think because, you know, I still hold the ability to set my own moral compass. I have the ability to set my own cultural agenda, right? Regardless of whether or not this MP or Adun who's representing me is, again, morally fit. So if that individual is committing some, you know, something in his or her private life, then so be it, as long as it doesn't affect me.
I think what the unfortunate outcome of people talking up the question of morality, in this case also the question of sexual morality and all those matters of private concern, is that it creates an atmosphere where people have to hide their human side. They have to hide their faults. And I think it leads to, in fact, hypocrisy in politics, that if we expect saints to be in parliament, then what we're going to end up electing is a bunch of hypocrites, because people have to pretend to be much better than they are. And, you know, and that, I think, is the unfortunate consequence of pushing this kind of religious / ethical type of discourse in politics.
Back to the whole sincerity thing as well, as we were talking about whether or not the people who you are electing or we are electing, to me, I feel what's important is the person sincere? Can the person walk the talk, right? It's at the end of the day, I think that's what is important.
Look, but, okay. Well, I guess, look, I'm trying to get to this idea, you know, whether or not we can have so-called immoral leaders.
Immoral leaders.
Well, morally unfit.
Or amoral. I mean,
no, Immoral. Okay. Immoral.
But not criminal, right?
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
And you know whether that's okay, because obviously that isn't reflected on the ground. Eh? Like you want those MPs or aduns who are representing you to be, you know, actually morally upstanding.
Okay, right? Tell us what you think. You can tweet us at BFM Radio, WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. What do you consider immoral or you know, something, an action that might cause somebody to be seen as morally unfit? And that's our question for you this morning. We're coming up to the top of the hour. We'll be back with more news and analysis. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. Good morning. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Tan Chung Han and Joyce Goh, and the morning run continues. We're taking you all the way up to 10 o'clock this morning. It's just 6.5 minutes past 7 in the morning, and it's it's the 17th of April, and it's a Tuesday. Of course, in the air, there's a lot of talk about the upcoming general election. And to get more insights into the question of how the Malaysian electorate has changed, I mean, the you and me in this story. I mean, Joyce, you voted before, haven't you?
Yes.
And Han, have you voted before? Ever?
Nope, because I was away for most of it.
Okay, so you have an excuse. So you don't feel ashamed. There's no shame in not participating. It's just
there's
a choice that you make.
Time,
or
yeah.
In some cases, okay. No choice.
Moving on.
Moving on. So we spoke to Dr. Koo Ning Hui. She is a senior lecturer at the Department of International and Strategic Studies at the University of Malaya. And we can't really have this discussion. I think a lot of us have thought about how things have changed over the last 15 years or so, especially from the late 90s, in terms of our behavior, what do we fear, and the kind of tricks politicians play on us, but tricks that we now perhaps can resist. Now, we get her input on the question of a changing electorate.
Well, I would say it is no longer as simple as before. Over the years, I think we must not dismiss the fact that the political awareness of the voters have increased due to many factors. For example, the help from the technology, such as the increased usage in social media like the Facebook, Twitter, or even the communication channels like the WhatsApp, where information is available with just one click. And I think we can't pin the voter base just as simply as where they stay, how much they earn. Apart from that, there's also many ways of how we actually can look at the voting pattern or the behavior of those voters. But whichever way that actually you wish to look at it, I think we should not dismiss the fact of the increased political awareness that I mentioned that has actually posed a challenge not only to the Barisan Nasional, but also to the Pakatan Harapan that we have right now.
We also asked her about the factors that have helped in raising political awareness.
One of the factors that we cannot dismiss is the role of the electoral reform movement, BERSE. And apart from the BERSE that calling out for the electoral reform, which generally, although we can argue that the structural reforms might not be there, or might be very limited. But I think the sentiments of the people are becoming more concerned or aware with their needs and the rights about their votes has generally increased. And I think that is one of the very important elements that we should actually look into as well.
And finally, we asked her what political parties can do to better understand their voters.
I think generally it's very often that I think we use this model of party identification because we kind of work in a context where it is very partisan. Either you are with the government coalition or you are with the opposition coalitions. So even if we look around the election survey, virtually we can see that every survey contains, to some extent, some form of the question that related to the party identification. So political parties, basically, they collect various data of the voters. But most of the time, I think the data can be very technical. And I think it is important that we understand that we're working with the voters' behavior that can change quite unpredictable. And until the day when we actually step into the voting center that we decide perhaps for some, that they decide whom their votes actually go to. And I think data aside, whether these changing patterns of partisanship and the electoral behavior, are they a boon or a curse for either the Barisan Nasional or the Pakatan Harapan? It is really depending on how the people and the political parties respond to the changes since 2008.
That was Dr. Ku Ning Hui, a senior lecturer at the Department of International and Strategic Studies at University of Malaya.
Interesting comments there. I mean, she's pointed out correctly, as you know, technology, social media, communication channels, you know, basically it has changed the whole state of play for everyone. And even for us voters, you know, where we can learn, you know, you can get a lot of information from or disinformation from, depending on which platforms or where you're getting your content from. But it has changed the whole, you know, the game.
Yeah, and I also want to, you know, perhaps talk about, you know, the idea of pledging an allegiance or even being a member of a political party. You know, help me understand this here. What's the appeal here? I guess aside from trying to build a career in politics, what would be the rationale there? Because based on your comments, right, you know, there is this, not just novelty, but there is this added weight almost, you know, right? If you do not pledge your allegiance to either side, but then when you go to the polls, it can swing either way, right? That would truly make you the kingmaker, right? Isn't that an added advantage of sorts?
Well, so if you the question for your first question, which is about why join a political party, and you say if you're not a career politician or you don't want to be a career politician, what would be the appeal? I think partly it's a question of identity. A lot of political parties in Malaysia, especially coming out of the independence movement, strive to be the vanguard of their communities, right? So there was a strong identification between political parties and especially in terms of ethnic groups, I think, in this country, right? So they have the UMNOs, the MICs, and the MCAs of the peninsula, at least, and that's very strong identification there. But, you know, often for our generation or younger generations, they think about politics in terms of what the party has to offer, what are their platforms, what are their ideological commitments. And it's got nothing to do with the society. Parties are just a range of options, right? Platforms. I think that's how I would see new changing relationships to political parties today.
But I guess for voters, right, for the individual voter, I guess that is a question mark, right, whether or not an allegiance or membership to a certain party is actually something that's beneficial, you know, when it comes to the broader political landscape. So, you know, I draw upon, well, if you look at the recent Undi Rosa campaign, right? No, I'm not encouraging it, but I would think that a lot of that movement is fueled by, you know, this lack of allegiance to either side, right? So because in their minds, both sides are not delivering on whatever promises they've made in the past, then I don't have to vote along those party lines. I can just go and undi rosa, so they say.
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, it depends on the individual, but I mean, there are voters who they vote for the personality more so today than the party. I think that is changing now. I think during our parents' time, I think so. If there are a number of people who I've been talking to and you're talking more about, let's see who's the candidate, who are they putting in place, rather than the party. And if remember yesterday we spoke to Ross.
Absolutely, Ross Tapsell from Australian National University. He made precisely the point. He says in rural Malaysia, they say, tengoklah calon.
Yeah.
Who is the candidate? Calon. That's more than...
That's changing.
But wasn't that framed by... Because that article in New Mandela came out before the announcement that Tun Dr. Mahathir was going to run in Langkawi, right? So that was in relation to Mahathir, wasn't it?
No, it wasn't. In fact, what was important was he was saying, he was taking a measure of the sentiment. So the person who was quoted saying, my grandfather voted for PAS, my father voted for UMNO, I'm voting for the best candidate. I don't have party loyalties. That was the point that Ross was trying to make in that part of his article.
Yeah, you can listen to our conversation with him. Download the app. Download the interview on BFM app.
Right. Also, Adrian Tai and Michelle Lowe have chimed in on the question of morally fit politicians or the the reverse of that, morally unfit. And Michelle says, listening to your discussion on the radio, I was wondering if being morally unfit will affect the way somebody leads. And Adrian Tai also makes the point. He says, well, if you're in that discussion we had about competence and morality, I would say to both of them, the issue is a system. I mean, no one politician is just making decisions of their own. I mean, it's only in systems where the executive has overwhelming power, there are no checks and balances, or political parties have dictators, or even the country has a dictator, that the moral leadership fitness of an individual becomes so important, right? Because in a truly democratic system, there is enough checks and balances that nobody's personal private morality becomes the undoing of that society.
Okay, I'm going to call you out on this then. So this somewhat negates what was just said just minutes ago, right? Because if you're voting for a system, then who cares about the individual candidate? No, are you voting for the system? Are you voting for the platform or the individual?
That's why people are voting, more and more people are voting for the individual rather than the platform.
But that's where the Malaysian electorate is, which is quite different from what my argument, of course, is that with the candidates, they also stand with parties who pledge, say, institutional reform in Malaysia. So I actually want to see institutional reform in this country because I think that is probably the most pressing need that we have. So we need more checks and balances. We need a system that goes away from the personal charisma of individuals in order that it's, you know, decision-making is more dispersed, you have competence and you have professionalism in politics, not leadership by the whims and fancies of individuals.
Sure, and I agree with you, right? But then as it stands right now, you know, you got to ask yourself as well, how much power do these grassroots individuals, the Aduns, etc., really have in implementing policy? Or, you know, as it appears to me, it's still a very top-down approach, right? You look at GE13, it was just framed as a battle between Dato Sri Anwar Ibrahim and Dato Sri Najib. GE14 looks like it's shaping up to be the same thing as well. It's a battle between Dato Sri Najib and Tun Dr. Mahathir, right?
But so, that's a function of and a symptom of our authoritarian system.
Ah, right.
It's
because
power has been so concentrated and in individuals who are the pinnacle of political parties that we have this kind of contest, right? To the extent that you want a more rational debate, you want policy debates, and you want it to go away from individuals, we have to have a much more democratic system.
Yes.
The question is, who's going to deliver that democracy to us, a truly democratic system to us?
So that point that Dr. Ross made yesterday, that Tengok Lah Calon, I'm still thinking that he's talking about Tengok Lah Calon at the top, as in like Tun Dr. Mahathir.
No, I think it's
Mahathir.
For Tengok Lah Calon, like, as in who you're going to be voting for when you go
really?
To the ballot box, and who you're going to take for. Yeah, I mean, even on the ground
with
when you're
the limited powers that they actually have. Okay.
Yeah, because it's aggregated, right? So it comes together. You vote for individual, and that's how democracy works.
Or
right?
The system.
Yeah. We don't have a presidential system. We'll be back with more news analysis. You can join this hot debate by tweeting us at BFM Radio or WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.